Hello everyone, I'm here with Greg Smith, who is a bond strategist specialising in emerging markets. Greg was also at the World Bank, where he's an economist in Zambia. And today we're going to be talking about what's been going on in Africa. Because whilst emerging markets, I guess, lagged the risk rally that we saw from credit after COVID initially took its toll in March, April, May, it has started to catch up. But some of the news flow coming out of Africa has been a bit more downbeat. Just looking at the FT over the weekend, Zambia on the brink of default over refusal to make overdue debt payment. And there's lots of little noises coming out of Africa that suggest it's not perhaps economically doing as well after COVID as areas like Asia, where, you know, China has recovered somewhat. So let's start with that, Greg, if we can. How is the COVID crisis? How has it been for Africa in general?
It's been very tough, like it has been globally, but the media is often negative towards Africa. But often what's happening among the 35 or the 55 countries is that some countries are doing well while others are struggling. And it's important to sort of get into that mix. But as we sort of see the global COVID cases hit around 59 million, only about 2 million of those cases have been recorded in Africa. So that's about 18% of the global population with just about 3% of cases. So Africa hasn't been hit as hard. And there are a number of sort of thing points raised about this. One is that there might have been less testing, but this is also backed by less deaths as well. And so people have put forward some reasoning on this, because early in the crisis, people thought cases would follow like they did in Latin America, but they didn't. African cases rose in June, but then they peaked in July. And while there's a risk of a second wave, people are pointing to demographics and preparedness. And the demographics point is that if you take Japan, which is about 28% of the population is over 65, it's about 19% in the UK. In South Africa and Egypt, it's only 5%. And if we go to Ghana, Nigeria or Senegal, only 3% of the population is over 65. So they have a much lower proportion that's vulnerable. And on preparedness, like the way that Taiwan and, say, Vietnam and China have done quite well at responding to the crisis because their experience with SARS, there's also an argument that Africa's efforts to tackle Ebola have helped inform them about disease spread and pandemics, and those skills have helped them deal with COVID. But on the economic side, it's still been tough. You know, we haven't seen as many full lockdowns, but we've seen curfews, we've seen travel bans. We've seen some commodities drop in price. Oil is obviously lower than we thought this year, although prices of copper are up on a two-year high. And these pressures have really put economies under a lot of pressure. But when I look through the IMF's forecasts for this year, we've got about, of 195 countries globally, we've only got 27 not in recession, and 12 of these in Africa. So joining China, Taiwan, Vietnam, we've got a number of countries that are actually growing despite this huge crisis, and they are Kenya, Egypt, Ivory Coast, Rwanda, Benin, and Ghana among them. And so we've got pockets of strength in Africa, but we've also got a lot of countries that have been hard hit.
And yet some of the headlines have been pretty negative, and I held up the FT one about Zambia. That's obviously a country that you know exceptionally well. Is this a trend? There seems to be growing fears about African debt issuance and just the levels of debt there and whether they will be able to service that debt going forward. Is it country by country again, or is there a theme emerging?
There's definitely a growing theme. Africa in the late 90s and early 2000s, a lot of African countries had full debt relief from mostly official creditors, and their debt to GDP ratios fell to historically low levels. But what we've seen in the years after that, particularly since the global financial crisis, is many new borrowing opportunities, some from traditional sources, the likes of the World Bank, the IMF, etc. But China's been a massive creditor over this period, including for its Belt and Road Initiative, and a lot of African countries have taken the opportunity to borrow from China. And then we've had market access. Although a few African sovereigns had access in the 90s, over the last 10 years, we've had many, many debuts of African countries issuing Eurobonds in either euros or dollars. And so that with these new borrowing opportunities, debt to GDP ratios have increased. And while these don't look high when you compare them to advanced economies, the pressure is a lot of this debt is external, and there's a lot of risks there. And so you need to be looking at indicators such as debt service to revenue and external debt to exports. And there you see vulnerability, and people are quite rightly flagging that. But among the countries, you need to be very careful to pick out the countries with the high debt problems, including those that have been pushed into default, like Zambia this year, with countries with much lower debt burdens that look sustainable even over the next 5-10 years.
And are emerging market economies in Africa still able to access capital markets? You know, obviously, over the last few months, we've seen both corporates and high yield issuance go through the roof for companies. Is it happening for African sovereigns as well? Are they able to access the generally lower rate environment that we'll be in to lock in long-term financing?
We've only got one African country still with an investment grade rating, and that's Morocco. But South Africa hasn't lost its last investment grade rating in March and was downgraded again last week, but it's still close to investment grade. And we've seen those large countries, Morocco, Egypt, have market access. And Egypt's come to the markets a couple of times, including with its debut green bond, where South Africa's actually chosen to stay out the Eurobond market this year because it's borrowed quite heavily in its own currency on domestic markets, and also managed to get emergency financing from the IMF for the first time because of the lack of conditions, where I think previously it would have pushed back on an IMF programme, but decided to take that cheaper and more concessional money. So they just didn't need to come to Eurobond markets. We had Gabon and Ghana come before the coronavirus hit properly in February, and then we haven't had much issuance, but spreads have now tightened to a level where some high yield countries in single B could come to market if they chose to. Although, as I said, still a lot of countries have had access to emergency financing this year and therefore haven't needed to. But we might see a couple more before the end of the year, perhaps Ivory Coast, and we'll certainly see two or three in quarter one of next year.
We kind of touched on China. China's had an increasing role within Africa recently, you know, as part of its kind of global ambitions. How have they lent to sovereigns in Africa? Is it project by project? And, you know, when it comes to bond investors getting their money back, do we have to worry about China being super senior to what might have been normally a senior lending into that government?
Almost all of China's lending has been for a specific project, often with a Chinese SOE doing the construction of the airport, the railway, or, for example, the hydro dam. And that's how it's been designed. The government does need to come up with a counterpart share. It might need to finance 10-15% from its own budget, but then the rest comes from China. Some of these loans are below market rates, and some of these loans are deemed commercial. And that's where China gets complicated, because China is many different types of creditor. It's got its Ministry of Foreign Affairs that do interest-free loans, or these are very small. I've seen a lot of African countries build stadiums with this money over the last 20 years. And then we've got the policy banks, the likes of China Exim Bank, who are investing in the railways and ports and power stations. And then at the other end of the spectrum, we've got ICBC and other sort of more commercial China lending. So you have to be careful about sort of which type of Chinese lender when you're making a point, but there's all sorts, and they've offered a lot. And when I look at the concentration of lending to Africa, you see a few countries pop up as having had the lion's share, and these include Angola, for example, and Ethiopia. Zambia is another country you mentioned that has borrowed a fair bit from the Chinese, but sometimes it's overstated. For example, it only makes up about a third of their debt stock. But this is where the complications come, because Zambia's managed to talk to different creditors and is getting some form of debt suspension from a couple of Chinese lenders. But it's really complicated, because they've got about one third of their external debt from the IMF and the World Bank and the Paris Club, one third from the different Chinese lenders, and one third in the Eurobond market. So it's really difficult to manage this complex portfolio and talk to everyone. And everyone feels they're senior to everyone else. The World Bank and the IMF feel they're senior to China. China feels they're senior to the World Bank and IMF. And the bondholders want to recover as much as they can from their lending as well. So it'll be a very interesting situation that will be difficult to resolve for Zambia over the coming months.
And thinking about debt relief, there has been talk of some kind of debt relief plan for Africa as a whole. Historically, that kind of debt jubilee idea, the pain, if it is pain, has been taken by the kind of supranationals like the IMF and the World Bank. Do you think that there'll be pressure for bondholders to take haircuts more widely across the African region to help relieve the damage that COVID and the slowdown in the global economy has done?
Back in March, when things looked really bleak for the global economy and markets had essentially frozen, there were some initiatives put forward, and one was called the Debt Service Suspension Initiative that was launched very early when they thought there would be many more cases than there had been in Africa. They thought the impact would be much greater. The plan then was for every creditor to offer a suspension regardless. But what they found in the months as markets recovered and some of the countries felt they weren't hit that hard, some countries didn't decide to join the initiative and stayed out of it for risk of losing their market access. And so there's been an ongoing debate since then about whether private creditors, whether China should be forced into this initiative. And some of the loudest voices on these calls have been the IFIs, and they themselves have felt that they shouldn't offer debt relief. The World Bank has insisted that it's not offering debt relief, but it should come from bilateral creditors and private creditors because they're lending at concessional rates. So it's been a complicated debate over the last, say, 6 or 7 months. But what we had over the last 2 months is an extension of this debt service suspension by the Paris Club and bilateral creditors, which will run until June next year. So a few countries have got some debt relief. Probably the biggest winners in this are Pakistan and Angola from this list of lower income countries, where some countries such as Ghana have decided, or Mongolia, for example, have decided not to be part of the scheme because they wouldn't get much relief from the creditors. China's, again, tended to do its own thing. It's doing bespoke deals on particular loans. We get some information. Their Minister of Finance said last week they've helped 23 countries, but we've got no details on what those countries are. Although we do know in the press that Zambia has secured some relief from two Chinese lenders. So it all gets very complicated. The big problem is the fact that the Paris Club does not have as members the new emerging creditors, China, but also India and some of the Gulf lenders. So until we get a global forum that encompasses everything, the Paris Club's always going to fall short. And that's why the G20 meetings are very important, because they put the US and America in the same room. But as we all know, the geopolitics haven't been easy this year. I think this is going to be a headache that continues over the next few years until we can find a sort of global consensus and work together in terms of this new reality of China being a major lender as well.
Okay, so over the past 2 weeks, we've had three vaccines discovered, including today's AstraZeneca one, which on the face of it looks best for the emerging markets. It's easiest to store and easier to distribute. So, you know, you've got to be pretty optimistic that COVID won't be in a year's time a huge issue for the global economy. So which areas of Africa are you most positive about in terms of economic growth and in terms of, I guess, thinking about their debt burdens and being able to manage those?
There's still a lot of uncertainty about how hard the hit was this year and how much countries will grow next year, who's going to be able to rein in large fiscal deficits over the next 2-3 years and who's going to struggle. But there are pockets that look particularly strong, and this was something we wrote about in Bond Vigilantes back in February, which was, as well as this big debt burden in Africa, we've got some countries that are becoming more active with their debt management. So they've joined the markets, they've done their debut bonds, and now they're coming back and doing liquidity management. They're looking at repayment risk and thinking ahead. So we've got countries like Ivory Coast who are looking at the amount of debt they're coming in a particular year and aiming to reduce that and smooth out their debt profiles. So those countries are very important. So they've not only got that sort of fast uptick of growth, but they've got this sort of more active debt management that helps deal with risks. So essentially it's we're going to learn over the coming quarters where that growth is. But I think where the debt management is more sophisticated, the debt risks are certainly lower. So what we look for is growth but also revenue keeping pace with growth. We've got a number of countries that grew really quickly over the past decade, but they haven't really generated the revenues from that growth to be able to pay back debt. And this isn't debt that can be inflated away. This is debt in US dollars and hard currency. So unless you're sort of earning that those FX revenues from remittances, from exports, it's going to be a struggle to pay back. So we watch those things very carefully. But the path of the virus, the vaccine, is still a massive load of uncertainty, and the sort of the biggest pressure African countries are facing. And for some, I'd say the oil exporters, a lot depends on where oil prices are in 2-3 years and whether those revenues recover. But that's a very difficult thing to forecast. But on the whole, I think there are bright spots as well as countries that are struggling. And we've sort of tragically had 6 sovereign defaults this year, but only one's been in Africa, although Africa still manages to get the worst of the press.
Great. Thank you very much, Gregory Smith.